Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we're here with another of our virtual events this evening. And tonight, Brian Klingborg joins us. We're going to be discussing his new book, Thief of Souls, which is just a beautiful cover. They did a really nice job with the design of the book. Welcome, Brian. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, for those of you watching on Facebook, I will be monitoring the comments field. So if you have questions for Brian, go ahead and put them in the comments, and I will reemerge towards the end of the hour to ask some of your questions. And I may have a few of my own, too. So
just
over
like
to you,
a
Barbara.
Chinese dragon or a Chinese gin or whatever it may be.
Yeah, we'll talk about Judge D maybe or some of those things.
We could talk about Judge D. Do you have any incense? It would be sort of fun, Brian, if you know you were able to light and wave some incense.
I have an incense burner, but I'm fresh out of incense.
Too bad. All righty. I am holding this book up because it is our international crime book for May. And it's always a pleasure to introduce readers, not just to new authors, but places they might not have gone. Love the cover. But where we are in China is a place that I have perhaps been on the edge of, but never actually gone. And I'm pretty sure I can't pronounce it, Brian. So why don't you tell us the name of the province and where it's located?
It's called Heilongjiang. And it's it means basically Black Dragon River. So it is a river that bisects northern China from Russian territory. And old place, interesting combination of Russian, Korean, and Chinese culture going way back, but a little bit remote and isolated and very cold weather. So, a foreboding place in some ways.
Well, China does have extremely cold weather up in the north. And I'm thinking we did a wonderful event for a nonfiction author whose specialty was the owls of Eastern Siberia. And I think he was somewhere near the border because we talked about that, the border between China and Russia. He was on the Russian side, but not terribly far. Does the Trans-Siberian Railroad touch any of this on its way to Vladivostok? It does, doesn't it?
Yes, excellent question. Actually, the city, the book is set in a small town called Raven Valley. That's the English name. The nearest big city is called Harbin, which is also known as City of Ice because it's so cold during the winter. They have a big ice schedule, a sculpture there, a festival and so on. But that was the terminus of the Trans-Siberian Railroad or a depot there that the Russians built in the late 1800s. So that's kind of how that city really became a metropolis. Before that, it was a much more smaller backwater town.
You know, I always wanted to do the trains. I've done lots of interesting railroad trips, and I always wanted to do that one. And then YouTube offered some videos for people who had actually taken the Trans-Siberian Railroad fairly recently. Mm-hmm. And after I watched it, I concluded that it wasn't going to be the railroad journey of my dreams.
Right.
In part because, the vision of old Russia, I was a Russian major, not a minor at Stanford, and I had a wonderful professor, Ivanovich Stenbach-Firmer, who on weekends taught profanity at the Army Language School of Monterey to potential spies, but that's back in like 1960. But I loved him. But I always had this wonderful vision of, these kind of old Russian cities and the Trans-Siberian Railroad to go through them. And now you look at it and, it looks like Shanghai, the island. I mean, it's all high rises and steel and glass and modern Germany or something, and all the romance of it is gone.
Yeah, the Chinese have a very strong train game. Their trains are very high tech for the most part. And I think a lot of the old romanticism is probably gone. But on the other hand, they're probably a lot more comfortable and a lot faster. So it kind of depends.
Absolutely. That's true. I mean, we were in, when I was in China, we also went to Macau while it was still Portuguese. I think it was 1997. And there was almost no new building. And in fact, there was a beautiful old Portuguese temple on an island. that, mm-hmm. I mean, at the southern part of the island, you know, to the fisher, I think she was a fisher god or something. It was gorgeous. And there was a wonderful old Portuguese restaurant where I got introduced to Vino mm-hmm. Verde, which has subsequently become a passion for me. By the way, I'm raising a glass to you. Thief of Souls. You're right.
And I'm going to join you with my Texas beer.
These are BYOB events we concluded not long ago, but good, more. Anyway,
I share this room with the cat, and the cat just decided to leave, so I had to shut the door. But
I have now seen pictures of Macau, and in 23 years, I can't even recognize it. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of Shanghai. When we were there, you could still walk down the Bund. I mean, it wasn't fabulous, but it was still there. And that island was almost completely empty. And now, mm-hmm. of course, it looks like Manhattan. So the Chinese have made some extraordinary, mm-hmm. accelerated extraordinarily in just over 2 decades. So you are a student, as I remember, of Asian studies and maybe Chinese cultural anthropology. How does this strike you? When was the last time you were in China?
I was in China about 3 years ago, went with my family. But the first time I went to China was when I was doing a junior year abroad in Taiwan. That was 1987. And my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and I took a 3-week trip through China, and we went by train. She actually grew up in Hong Kong. So we went into Hong Kong, and then we took the train to Guangzhou. And from there, we traveled around for 3 weeks. And talk about rustic trains. Those were rustic trains back in those days. They had, as I recall, 3 levels, the soft sleeper, the hard sleeper, and just the hard. You know, the hard was just a seat. So we took the soft sleeper, which by no means was luxurious, but it was definitely a cultural experience. So we would get off in the big cities, walk around for a few days. And then that time when we went to Shanghai, there had been no new construction. I don't know if this for a fact, but there didn't appear to have been any new construction, certainly since the communist takeover in 1949. There were a lot of beautiful old buildings there that were built by foreign concessions in the late 1800s and early 1900s, magnificent buildings that were empty or derelict. I can remember going into what may have been a department store in the 1920s or 30s, and it was just this huge spacious place. And there, you know, there was a guy there with a mat on the floor selling cotton shoes. There were no products, there was no retail. And, you know, people talk about the Iron Rice Bowl. So back in those days, the social system was such that your work and all aspects of your life were dictated by your local work group. And you didn't get more money for working harder. You didn't get tips and promotions and things like that, depending on your production. So people just kind of coasted to some extent. There was no incentive for them to work harder. You would go into a restaurant and you would sit quietly. I remember distinctly sitting quietly until somebody brought us a menu, because if you asked for the menu and upset them, they'd be like, forget this guy, and they wouldn't bring you the menu. So, you know, it was a very different place. Hard to get around. There wasn't a lot of food. I mean, there was the food wasn't of great quality. There were no foreign goods to speak of, but very interesting experience. And that was 87. The next time I went to Shanghai was probably, I want to say, 96 or 97. And, you know, it would completely transform. There were skyscrapers and so on. I haven't been there since then, but I have been to Beijing. And Beijing has changed a lot. The first time I went to Beijing in 87, they had these huge concrete highways, but no cars. Now the traffic is abysmal, you know, and everybody's got luxury cars, and you just can't get anywhere, even in the city, you know, in the space of less than an hour and a half. So as with any developing country, there are a lot of pros and a lot of minuses. A lot of people have benefited and a lot of people have been left behind. And it's become a real issue. The income disparity and social inequality has become a real issue in China.
Well, of course it has. And not only that, the environmental stuff, I mean, it reminds me of, you know, the London fog in the 1950s that were sold, the Great Smoke and so forth. I mean, we were in Beijing, you could barely breathe. Mm-hmm. And not only is it, you know, automobile and other pollution, but the dust sweeping in from the West
right.
is a huge problem in northern China and can make it a nightmare. I am a huge fan of the Chinese novels by Qu Shelong, who has become a friend. And I think Death of a Red Heroine did a brilliant job depicting the Shanghai that you are talking about, where, you know, there were neighborhood wardens and mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. Tom Bradby wrote a really brilliant book. And Patrick, you can look it up on your phone. I think it was called something like 20 Days of Rain or Rain or something. But anyway, set in the 1920s in the Bund part of Shanghai, when it was still actually operating with European concessions. And, you know, there's a lot, we can talk about Judge Dee and other great stuff as we move along, but yours is a book that is set in a place that we're not familiar with, and in contemporary China. So is it Lu Fei or Lu Fei? How do you pronounce it?
Fei, yeah, Lu Fei.
Lu Fei, okay. Mm-hmm. And is that the Chinese thing where Lu is the family name and Fei mm-hmm. is his Christian name? Okay.
Exactly.
Or sorry, not Christian, but you know.
I know what you mean. Give a yeah. name.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Right. Which is like Qu Shelong. I mean, his real name is Shelong, right? Okay, Tom Bradby, Master of Rain. Thank you. I love the chat feature. Patrick is always able to save me when I have these moments. If you've never read Master of Rain, I can highly recommend it to you because it really does take you back into that wonderful period in China. We were in Hong Kong. Again, they had the clock was actually down by the water and it was counting down the days until,
right.
until the British left.
The so handover.
Mm-hmm. Never, yeah. yeah. So never saw the romantic haze of British Empire over Hong Kong. Saw it when it was actually just in limbo and barely yeah. functioning. So it was an interesting transition. Closest I ever got to where you are was really this section of the Great Wall that is near Beijing, which is fairly far north. How far is it from Harbin?
I don't know in terms of miles or kilometers, but quite far.
Oh, it is,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why did you elect to set your book in a province that is so unfamiliar?
Well, because, generally speaking, if you're going to read a book set in China, it's in Shanghai or Beijing. Just like, you know, if you're going to read a book set in France, it's often in Paris or New York or Los Angeles in the US. So I wanted to do something different. And I'll be, you know, this is perfectly honest and perhaps secret. I've never been to Harbin. I don't know Harbin very well. So I needed to choose something that I could research, but also remake to some extent the way I needed it to be remade. Now, when I write the book, when I've written these books or any book that I've written, I've been very careful about researching actual places, including road names, structures, buildings, and so on and so forth. So most things that appear in Thief of Souls are real settings, real places, or, you know, some amalgamation of something that I've found. But I did need some flexibility to write a story set in a Chinese city that I didn't necessarily need to have walked down the street and said, this is on that corner and this is on this corner. But I also wanted, as part of my protagonist's backstory, for him to have been an up and coming police officer, somebody who was on the rise, who was doing great things, but then essentially got relegated to a more backwater town because of corruption or whatever. And that's part of his backstory. And Harbin kind of fit the bill of being close to, you know, being a large major city, but also having a place that he could perhaps be relegated to that would still provide some interesting backstory. Also, Harbin is just a really interesting place, you know, from what I understand. As I mentioned, it really grew when the Russians were there creating the terminus for the railway. It had a very large traditional Jewish population. So it had a real international concession in the late 1800s, unlike a lot of other cities in China. Also, you know, when was wrested back and forth between the Japanese and the Chinese and so on. So there's a lot of interesting information there, interesting historical background that I hope to dig into later on in later books.
Well, yeah, because we don't really spend that much time in Harbin in this book. So what is the name of the backwater to which Lu Fei has been assigned? And did you make that up? Is that an entirely fictitious village?
Yeah, it's entirely fictitious. There is a real location, more or less, but I call it Raven Valley. And I wanted something that had the connotation of, I originally had a name which was Wuxi, which had some negative connotation related to Chinese bird mythology, but it was too complicated and I thought it might be too difficult to pronounce. So I just changed it to Raven Valley, keeping the raven part of it. And I did a lot of research on the topography of the area, finding what flowers and flora were there. And there are some beautiful valleys. It is kind of a river valley. So that just kind of came together as a last minute idea.
I was noticing that your English publisher is calling this book City of Ice, not Thief of Souls. Why do you think they're these two titles? I mean, because publishers, for those of you who don't know this, generally get to decide titles. Authors can be consulted, but really it's up to marketing and sales and publishing houses to a great degree about what to call a book. So what do you think it says, Thief of Souls for an American audience and City of Ice for a UK and Continental Office audience?
Well, my title is Thief of Souls. My title was City of Ice, because it relates to the nickname of Harbin. Right. But I think Minotaur thought that there were several books out there with that title, that it maybe wasn't evocative enough of the Chinese setting. So we went back and forth, and actually my editor finally came up with Thief of Souls, and we went with it because there is a, you know, not to spoil anything, but there is an aspect to the book which has to do with the soul and what, you know, the motive of the killer, basically.
Right. Well, I think it's a good title. And we've already all said that we think the cover is very dramatic. I was just curious as to which one, you know, was yours, if either, because it's right. Possible that you didn't actually title either book. So in the village, what's it called?
Raven Valley.
Raven Valley. Right. You made up, I presume, you created the bar in which Lu Fei seems to spend more time than he should. And, you know, he is a drinker. And I think that's true in a lot of Chinese culture. I sort of, you know, you do imagine many of them really pound it down. And maybe in a northern cold place. See, I have a theory that there are reasons why people in Ireland and Scotland and Russia, possibly Iceland and all, drink a lot. Because, you know, you have to find some way to get through all the cold and the dark. And and so I'm wondering if that wouldn't be true in southern or western China. I mean, if you know Elsa Hart's books, her wonderful 18th century books about China, which I think are absolutely brilliant, although the last one is in fact in Beijing, and still in the 18th century. I don't know if the drinking culture is as predominant all over China, or whether it tends to fasten itself upon some of the more extreme climates. You have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think if you look back at Chinese literature and poetry, especially, a lot of the poets were big drinkers, and they would get together on a beautiful moonlit night and sit outside where they could appreciate nature and drink wine and compose poems, you know, as entertainment. And there's an aspect of Taoist, kind of Taoist exploration, mental exploration, freedom, freeing yourself from your body in different ways. They didn't have drugs per se, but they certainly experimented with different kinds of elixirs. But drinking, you know, was something that has become part of Chinese culture, most generally in a joyful way, a happy way where you're being convivial, talking to your friends, and you're kind of expanding your mind. So you're extolling the virtues of nature, you're creating poetry, you're playing games and having a good time. It's a joyful thing for the most part, I believe, in Chinese culture.
But not for Lu Fei, as it all turns out, because he's actually not a particularly happy person.
I guess you could say he's a little emotionally shut down, but I don't think that's definitely unusual for anybody who lives in a society where they aren't free to explore their dreams perhaps in the way that they want to, or there isn't a lot of social mobility. He's definitely a lonely person in some ways, and he's, you know, China's got an interesting situation with gender disparity. So because for many years there was a one-child policy, and because in Chinese culture the family line is carried down through the father's side, and through male children are valued, and there are fewer females out there now than there might have been otherwise. So finding a suitable mate is getting really difficult. There's lots of different dating sites and different things that are setting people up. But for a guy like Lu Fei, who wants to marry for love rather than just make a match that's a good family match that will provide children and so on and so forth, you know, it might be harder for him to meet somebody. Doesn't feel like jumping on a dating site or something like that. So yeah, he spends his time drinking and kind of pining for Yen Yen, who is the owner of this bar, from afar. You know, and their relationship will develop as the story continues. I don't think his drinking is unjoyful or it's excessive, sure, but it's, you know, he's not a mean drunk or anything like that. And he does say a couple of times about how he is seeking inspiration through inebriation. So I don't know if that's a good message or not, but every now and then, if you have a couple of drinks, something might occur to you that otherwise wouldn't, when you're allowed to unfetter the mind. So that's basically what's going on with him.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to imply that he was a mean drunk or that he was necessarily drunk. I mean, he drinks a lot, but I don't know, you know, lots of people, I am not one of them. I'm a one glass of wine person and then it's all over for me. But there are people who can drink amazing amounts and still stay relatively sober. So, you know, I can see, what would he do on long cold nights
right. In
the village? You know, it's interesting that the analogy between the Chinese male today after the one child policy, where girl children were sadly often killed or, you know, given away or other bad things. Very much like what happened to English women after World War I, when so many men were killed and many of them became, you know, were spinsters for life, because it was impossible for them to, with a small pool of men available, to find mates. So, you know, timing is so much of life, isn't it? Mm. Where you find yourself in what situation can determine many things about your life in which you had no say whatsoever.
Mm. Perhaps it's fate.
Well, probably is. Yeah. You know, what can I say? But anyway, okay, so here he is in the valley, and he has a superior officer with whom he has considerable tension and not a lot of mutual respect a lot of the time. So that always seems to be a function of, not always, but in many police procedurals, to introduce tension and conflict, we do have that kind of dynamic going on, either with a, you know, fellow officer or with a superior officer or something, but you wind up with dynamics within the actual police department as separate from whatever's going on in the investigation, and they're chasing after bad guys and justice. So you set that up, I'm assuming, for those reasons?
Are you referring, well, he's got a direct superior, Chief Liang, who he has a pretty good relationship with, because Chief Liang is kind of a lazy ne'er-do-well who recognizes that Lu Fei is a smart guy and can take care of things while he's out doing karaoke. But then when the murder occurs, the Criminal Investigations Bureau from Beijing is called in, and that guy, Mr. Song, Deputy Director Song, is the guy that is really kind of hard to work with. And yes, Song is a politician, essentially. And as I'm sure you know, if you look at what's going on in Chinese politics, all of these ministries and all of these people who are rising in power, they're kind of subject to different kinds of vagaries of fate and relationships that they know, and they have to tread very carefully. So Song's a guy who's very ambitious, and he knows where he wants to get. And in order to get there, he's willing to cut corners or to push, sweep things under the rug or whatever. Not to a really bad extent, but certainly, his ambition drives him. So he and Liu Fei have some tension in the fact that Liu Fei doesn't believe the initial suspect is the killer, and Song is more interested in closing the case than really, and then getting out of Harbin, because, in his job, he travels all around the country constantly investigating cases. So there's some tension there, but I think they come to an understanding, a mutual respect. And Song will appear in later books in a similar fashion, where he's both helpful and harmful at the same time.
Well, Song is not a red prince, in which case he wouldn't have to do a whole lot, but right. He's definitely ambitious. And I find that interesting, that whole dynamic with red princes, people connected to, to the higher echelons of the party, not really so much the higher echelons of government, but really the higher echelons of the Communist Party, mm-hmm. which is, it's changed slightly in the time since, well, a lot since Mao started it, but in the last, couple of decades, that right now it's in an iron grip. It was a little bit looser earlier, and it's difficult to know how it will go forward and how much the forces of capitalism will create change. And, so many things are going on in China. So far, no purely communist society has ever really flourished. And, so it'll be some sort of blend of capitalism, socialism, capitalism, whatever it all is. But you said that earlier, and it's so true, that really in a purely communist society, there's not a lot of incentive for anybody to do anything. Right. And as soon as you revert back to individualism and some form of capitalism, then you get some people who are more aggressive and more mm-hmm. ambitious than others. And Song is a good example of that. Do you see Liu Fei as that kind of person who got derailed? Do you see him coming back to that? Is he going to be happy just sitting in his village?
Well, that's a good question. The way he phrases it is that he's happy to be there because he's a guy who came of age just after the Cultural Revolution, but the Cultural Revolution touched everybody. So his parents were sent away as youth were in those days to work in the fields and so on, derailing their education, being sent thousands of miles away from home for 10 years or more. Part of the backstory is that his grandparents were bourgeois artists or professors, so they were sent to re-education camps, and some of them never came back. And the Chinese people are still dealing with the aftermath of that. In the old days, you could never criticize the Cultural Revolution or Mao, but now they're like, well, he did some good things and some bad things. So very slowly, some criticisms are coming out, and people are coming to terms with that history. But for Liu, he's a guy who, having seen injustice, what he considers injustice firsthand, and kind of the heavy hand of the government, became a police officer because he wants to protect the ordinary citizen from such, bureaucracies. And he feels that the best way to do that is to be a policeman and decide who is guilty of a crime and who is not, or at least investigate and figure that out. So when he's remanded to Raven Valley, which is a small town, he has a much closer relationship to the people there and is able to, the crimes are far less degree, but he's able to have a more say in what's going on. And he claims that he's content away from the corrupt issues that he faced on a daily basis in the Harbin Police Department. Whether or not that's, you know, a bit of rationalization or not is hard to say. His story will change. He can't stay there forever. You know, in this book, he's 38 or 39 years old. And so he's got 20 years of his career ahead of him, and something will have to happen. But always, as long as his love interest, Yen Yen, is working at the Red Lotus, his locus will be Raven Valley. Unless they break up or something, I don't know.
Well, and they, you know what? You're the only one who will know if that's going to happen. It'll be.
I don't even know.
You don't even know right now. Of course, you have a lot more exploring to do. So we can't talk very much about the actual investigation, but you can at least give us the instigating incident. What is the crime that touches off the narrative, the mystery or narrative of the book?
So the crime is that a young woman is discovered in her home alone. And sorry, my cat is coming back in. She's been murdered and some of her internal organs have been removed. Then she's been sewed back up, washed and dressed, and makeup put on her face. So she looks, you know, like a little doll in some ways. And a square of folded paper money, lucky money, death money, has been put in her mouth. So that's what touches off the investigation. You know, is it somebody who's stealing organs to resell? Is it a sex crime of some kind? You know, there's weird ritualistic aspects to it. What talents would it take? What abilities would it take for somebody to remove those organs, knowing where the organs are, and to sew the body back up? You know, that kind of thing. So that touches off the investigation.
Yeah, just a little hint of Jack the Ripper, except not really, because no. But I mean, you know, anytime a body is violated that way, I think it raises hackles, because that's not, you know, like an ordinary domestic murder. Most of the time, I mean, most murders are really committed by family members, you know, people or people in a circle that that know the person. But in this case, that brutality kind of argues that maybe there was no real personal connection between the victim and whoever whoever did the murder. So that's all we can say. But it's an interesting premise on which to go forward. What do you see? You know, are you working on a second book already?
I've written a second book. It's with my editor, so he's going to get back to me soon. Yeah.
Right. And again, with Lu Fei as the protagonist.
Yes. So the second book is touched off by a missing persons case, which leads to the illegal trade in animal parts in China. Also touches very briefly on, I know people don't want to read too much about this, touches briefly on the coronavirus situation in China, and how it's hampered the illegal animal trade, because post-coronavirus, the government has issued a new decree on what can and cannot be farmed for food and so on. But Chinese traditionally have incorporated animal products as part of their medicine, their medicinal remedies, and also remedies for virility and so on and so forth. So it's a huge, huge market. And in the second book, Lu Fei kind of ends up tracing this down a black hole, which leads him all the way down into Burma or Myanmar, which is where this trade is originating. So it's, you know, he goes very far afield for the second book.
That's really interesting. I mean, I've hosted two events in the last little while about the illegal poaching in Africa of animal and animal parts for it. But the huge market of it appears to be Vietnam, or at least the big distribution center is Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Although much of the end result is in fact China. And, you know, interestingly enough, I'm a Vietnam War widow, but when I was in Vietnam, in Hanoi, with a great reluctance, I finally agreed to go to the War Museum there. Mm. And I was really surprised to discover that 85% of the space at the War Museum in Hanoi is devoted to Vietnam's long struggle with China. And mm-hmm. only a tiny bit is devoted to what they call the American War, mm-hmm. which for them was just kind of a blip in their ongoing mm-hmm. thousand-year struggle.
That's correct, yeah.
With China. And that was a real surprise to me, you know, yeah. because for us, it looms so much larger than mm-hmm. it does for the Vietnamese. And, you know, it's important to remember that they have a contiguous southern border in part, just the way Russia has a contiguous northern border.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the whole question of Taiwan and, you know, did Chiang Kai-shek really escape with, you know, much of the imperial treasure, and is it somewhere mm-hmm. in Taiwan, or did it all drop into the ocean, or it's, you know, buried under a mountain, or there's so many different things that that one can think about in viewing China. Mm-hmm. So I'm a huge devotee of the Judge D mysteries written by Robert Van Gulik. I have mm-hmm. read them all. Mm-hmm. And when I go to New York to the Metropolitan Museum, I always visit the Chinese wing and sit in the Chinese garden and, you know, envision the judge. And you know, even though those were written in the Tang Dynasty, which was what, like fifth or sixth century BC, AD, or whatever the Chinese call
it. Yeah, 900s, around the 900s.
Was it that much? Okay. But so much of the, you know, the bureaucracy, people sitting for exams in order to prevail in the civil service, you know, the role of the judge and how he functioned in the judiciary and the civil service, the family structure, mm-hmm. all of those things really are surprisingly timeless. And then you can go all the way to Xi'an and, you know, visit the terracotta warriors and recognize that that emperor, I've always loved that story, you probably know it, mm-hmm. but, you know, he was very powerful. And mm-hmm. when he died, nobody wanted to acknowledge that, at least mm-hmm. his immediate followers. So mm-hmm. they put him on ice and they drove him around for quite a long time. Although the warriors were supposed to protect his tomb. But as I remember it, his tomb has still not been opened because mm-hmm. the idea is that it's floating in some sea of mercury or something mm-hmm. very, very mm-hmm. toxic. So if anybody ever does figure out or does the same way that if they ever find the tomb in Mongolia of which mm-hmm. one is it, Kublai Khan?
Yeah, I think
or the other Khan, you know, whatever.
Genghis
Khan, right. Or, you know, if you neither the tomb of Cleopatra nor Alexander the Great has ever been found in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there are these really wonderful archaeological potential mm-hmm. finds out there. But I do think the consistency of Chinese civilization all the way up to Mao, mm-hmm. from the guy that, you know, was the terracotta warrior king, mm-hmm. was remarkable. Mm-hmm. And what do you think broke it? Was it the war that broke it? Was it the Japanese invasion of Manchuria? What is it that caused such an enormous change to China?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at China up until around the 1600s, it was perhaps, you know, the most advanced civilization in the world, maybe late 1500s. They had the compass early, you know, they had various kinds of machines and so on, but medicine, of course, literature, but, and this is just a guess, you know, in China, there were enough people and land and resources, unlike Japan, for example, that you didn't have to get super creative sometimes in order to survive, in order to grow food and things like that. You had enough people that you didn't have to develop really advanced weapons to overcome a disparity with your enemies. You were isolated, therefore, you were not interacting with certain cultures and picking up technologies and things like that. And China had an issue with the way the government was run, which is exactly what you said. In those days, you could be born into royalty or so on, but the main way people became powerful was through the educational system. And that educational system was based on non-scientific pursuits, such as the proper way to write a memorial to the emperor, how to write a poem, things like that. Beautiful things, but not practical. So you had an entire administration of people who didn't really have practical knowledge on things like irrigation, engineering, political science. You also had an emperor who was the ultimate power, who was often, China has a saying about the first three emperors of every dynasty were great. After that, they were all terrible because they're enclosed in a palace and surrounded by eunuchs who take care of their every need and ministers who are whispering in their ear. And they just, smoke opium and hang out with their concubines or something rather than really try to rule. The government was not efficient. The way it was structured was not efficient. And things just slowly fell apart. It was a long downward trajectory leading to a lot of, they had the Taiping Rebellion in the 1850s, killed millions of people, Boxer Rebellion. And then around that time I think probably the main thing was the Opium War of 1842,
which is,
where Hong Kong was ceded to British territory. The English and other nations, French and so on, wanted goods from China. They wanted porcelain, things like that. And the thing that they found that they could sell most easily was opium. And so they were importing opium and forcing the Chinese to buy opium to get money to pay for these other Chinese goods. And the Chinese military was not strong enough to resist these efforts. And so they had to secede territory. They had to secede in the north and in Shanghai and so on and so forth, create these concessions. And they just continued this downward spiral until they kind of went through their death throes of the imperial system, and the emperor was overthrown in 1911. And then they had a period with Chiang Kai-shek and Sun Yat-sen where they tried to create a republic, which was a fertile time for them to think about different political systems and try and create something new, a new society, try to modernize their military. But, China's a big country, it's very spread out, and a lot of these provinces were ruled by warlords who really wanted to just have their own localized power. So it was very difficult for them to unite as a country and move forward. Then, of course, the Japanese invaded. So it's just one thing after another, starting in the 1800s, basically.
It's an interesting parallel to Versailles and, what happened after Louis XIV, isolated the court. So Louis XV and XVI were, just as you say, isolated from the country, and things kind of fell apart. But I also think it's really hard for a country like Russia or China, to loosen that. We're probably seeing that in the United Arab Republic and so forth today. Mm-hmm. Hope we're not going to see it here in the U.S., although I think we came perilously close to it not long ago, and we'll see what the fallout is. Patrick, let's call you up. I don't have any incense. I just have wine.
Brian, actually, I have a couple of questions for you. I read a little bit about your history, and tell us a little bit about Kung Fu, North Shaolin Kung Fu to be particular. Do you practice it yourself? I know you've been involved in several books.
Yes. Not lately, but yes. As a kid, I took a couple years of karate because most young boys want to learn martial arts because they think they'll, be superhuman in some manner. But I didn't love it. I found the atmosphere kind of rigid, and not to be disrespectful to Japanese martial arts, because there's a lot of great tradition and great martial artists. Just wasn't for me. And then later on in college, I joined a Kung Fu group. It just happened to be the Kung Fu group that was at my undergrad, and found a completely different atmosphere. my teacher, Sifu, that's the Cantonese term, most, you know, most Kung Fu from Asia has been imported through the southern provinces. So a lot of the terminology we use in the US is Cantonese terminology when we're talking about Kung Fu. But anyway, my Sifu was a very famous guy named Lai Hong, famous he's from Hong Kong, and was a full contact fighter in the days when there weren't a lot of Kung Fu guys that were going to Thailand and other places and engaging in these, you know, these bouts of fisticuffs. He tells some stories about Bruce Lee and so on. These guys, they're also catty, but in any case, he was the real deal and he was a good guy. I really, you know, developed, I wouldn't call it a father-son relationship, but that is kind of sort of the feeling in a Chinese Kung Fu school, which I really enjoyed. And I developed a good social group. And in the process, of course, I was studying Northern Shaolin. So I studied that for some years with Lai Hong. And when I would go when I went to Taiwan, for example, I would study whatever was there, you know, with different results. I wouldn't say I was always super gung-ho, but it became something that I just did. Instead of jogging, for example, or going to the gym and lifting weights, I would go, you know, do it to the Kung Fu class. And then I really found kind of a home when I moved to New York with a school here, two particular teachers, Matt and Chris, who come out of a federation of a Southern Shaolin Kung Fu school here in New York. Found a great group of friends, and that's the one I stuck with for the next 10 or 12 years, and eventually did some teaching and so on. But Kung Fu is a hard thing to make a living at, or even to keep a school together, because Kung Fu's hard, you know. And if you want to study Kung Fu for real, you're going to get hit in the face, and people don't want to get hit in the face. So, you know, it's not aerobics or something like that. You have to have a certain mentality, and some extent a young man's game.
Is there a spiritual component to it, or a meditative aspect to it, like some of the other disciplines?
There is. There are some, you know, there's Qigong, which is basically a moving meditation, which is breathing and moving, which is to develop, you know, your inner chi, your power or whatever, and your focus. The process of learning Kung Fu teaches you body alignment and breath, because those things are what create the movement of your body, and the alignment of your body and the breath with that movement is what creates the power for Kung Fu. Kung Fu is not magic, but you can punch really hard with Kung Fu by using your breath and your body in a certain way, things like that. I never really got too much into the meditation aspects, and there are different schools of Kung Fu which have more of that and some that have less. But for me, the thing was, you know, it was conflict, training and resolution, because if you strap on the gloves and stuff and you're going to spar, it's scary, you know, it's scary. And when you do it afterwards, you feel, you know, you get a sense of accomplishment. You're like, I did that. And what people talk about in martial arts is you can be in a situation where people will start, where you might be tempted to engage in violence if you're afraid. But with Kung Fu, the idea is you just let it go. You're not afraid. It's not a big deal. You've got nothing to prove. It's just kind of a mindset that I develop, or that one develops through Kung Fu.
Right.
Or martial arts in general, I think.
There's an author. Barbara, did you know that Joe Lansdale is a martial arts master?
No, I didn't.
He is terrifying. There are a couple, next time he's here, I'll have to show a few things. But he was in the back room, and he has his own school in Nacogdoches, Texas, of all places. Mm-hmm. And he developed his own type. But we asked him to show a few things, and it is truly terrifying. Mm-hmm. To just a few moves. And his whole thing is get in, get out really quickly. You know, don't let it escalate. And but tell us a little bit. So you ultimately wrote two books with another author, I believe, mm-hmm. on this topic, right?
Well, going back to Lai Hong, as I mentioned, he was a guy who was very famous in Asia, but not at all known in the United States. Whereas there are a lot of Kung Fu teachers in the US who got famous writing books and making videotapes, but they weren't as accomplished, weren't, I didn't think they're as good, and they had no authentic combat background. I don't want to sound like a meathead, but, you know, Kung Fu is a martial art. So it is ultimately intended for self-defense, so that it should be one aspect of it. If you're just doing forms, that's not exactly what it's all about. And I think people lose the essence of Kung Fu when they don't put it into practice. So Lai Hong was the real deal, and I thought he deserved a little more recognition. So I wrote this first book, and it published it with Tuttle. It's still out there somewhere on eBay. The second one I wrote because I had some training brothers who, you know, had been around a long time, and I thought that maybe they could contribute something as well. So we just kind of got together and did a second book. And there we are.
Right. And also you published an earlier novel just a few years ago from Midnight Ink. That was a contemporary thriller set out here in the West. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that just for a minute or two?
Sure. That book was called Kill Devil Falls. It's about a female U.S. Marshal who's sent to a remote town in the San Joaquin Mountains. And the town has been condemned because it's an old mining town. So it's riddled with mines underneath and it's unstable. The county has decommissioned it, but there's a few odd hangers-on that continue to live there for various reasons. She's up there to collect a fugitive. She finds out the fugitive maybe stashed some money up there and people are after it. She's not sure who's on her side and who's not. It all takes place in the space of one evening. And it's very, very violent book, a real dark kind of a crime thriller.
Right. And that was
Midnight Ink is no longer in business, because I don't know that it's possible to get much of their list available right now.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I'm thankful to them for publishing the book, but there was no press whatsoever behind it, and it went out of print about 6 months before Midnight Ink folded. So,
right.
So it's
out was a small press, also. And you know, small presses have hazardous histories.
Yeah,
so
sure.
That's it. Before we close, for those who are interested in reading about China through the realm of crime fiction, I mentioned Robert van Gulik, a Dutch diplomat who wrote these wonderful books about Judge D, as I mentioned earlier, a Tang dynasty official. And he also had these great line drawings that appear in the books. I think the University of Chicago publish them. I hope they're still in print, but if not, I really recommend you look for them. I mean, they're, what we say, 9th century, roughly, the Tang dynasty, but really relevant to China today. Qiu Shilong has written a wonderful series set in Shanghai, primarily. It's spelled Q-I-U-X-I-O, let me see if I can remember it,
X-I-A-O.
A-I-A-O, L-O-N-G. Wonderful, wonderful writer, Chinese by birth, teaches in Missouri, in St. Louis at a college, and has written very well, I think, about the pitfalls of the Chinese bureaucracy, and especially the Red Princes and the Communist Party. They're great. An author you may not know, Ian Hamilton, who writes one of my favorite series with a Chinese basically an asset recovery specialist, although she's kind of branched out a bit, called Ava Lee. And there's a large Chinese community in Toronto, Vancouver and Toronto in China, in Canada. And her Chinese father's second wife, they separated, and the second wife, Ava Lee's mother, lives in Toronto in some luxury. The father comes to visit for a couple of weeks every year. But Ava Lee takes you into all kinds of businesses in China and the financial system. And recently, Ian, because she had a mentor called Uncle, who swam from mainland China to Hong Kong across the water during the Cultural Revolution and became an important figure in the triads. So there's a lot of interesting morality in these books, so Uncle is getting his own, because he eventually died in the Ava Lee series, because he was, but we're getting to see Uncle when he was younger in kind of previews. And if I think they're fabulous because they really explore things that very few mystery novels do, you know, like the fashion industry and so forth, and which is a huge thing in China and an enormous economic engine. So those are all things that I can recommend. There used to be a British author. Do you remember his name, Patrick, who wrote some really very good books about China? And then
I want to say Christopher West.
Yep, that's it. Exactly. Christopher West. And unfortunately, you probably have to find those as ebooks, but very good. And then, of course, my very longtime friend and marvelous author, Lisa C, who writes wonderful historical set in China, although she's coming up to the modern, but believe it, she wrote three mysteries, which not everybody realizes. The first was called The Flower Net, and then she went off with Snowflower and The Secret Fan and has not returned to crime fiction, even though I nag her about it frequently. Anyway, those are all things that you can read in addition to Brian's excellent book, Thief of Souls. So are there any questions, Patrick, that you might want to ask that I interrupted you from doing?
Not really. I don't really have any specific questions here. People are definitely tuning in and watching and enjoying the discussion. One quick point before we break off. I like what you were talking about with the protagonist in some ways sort of protecting the people against the machine, you know, of government or corrupt power. It reminds me a little bit of, there's a great series set in Mexico City by Paco Ignacio Taibo. And he writes a very quirky, interesting detective series set there. And the whole notion of being a detective in the environment where I think they estimate 75% of all crime originates from within the police department is kind of an interesting idea. And it's along the same line. So those are, I don't know why, I just thought that would be something to throw on the table. Great series.
What's the name of one of the books?
Let's see, the first one was called Cosa Fácil, An Easy Thing. And they were published here for a minute in the late 80s, 90s.
They were, and then Poison Pen Press actually published a couple of them before he disappeared.
They're really...
There's some over in the Poison Pen.
Yeah. One of the best titles ever, which is No Happy Ending. That's one of his titles.
Indeed.
But I think you might like them if they're in that tradition.
Very good.
And that's about it. Wow.
Thank you so much.
Barbara's frozen on us.
Right. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Brian. A real pleasure to meet you. I hope you will come back and visit us with your second book.
Love to. Thank you.
This is, you can tell from this, when people, publicists ask me for a run of show, I laugh because there really isn't one. You know, we make it up as we go along. And part of the reason is, for those of you watching, there's only a little we can discuss about the actual mystery in the book without ruining it. So we wind up sort of wandering all over the place. But I think that's a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy it too. Thanks for watching. Don't forget, Thief of Souls is the actual book. We have copies of The Poison Pen. And tell your friends to catch the podcast. It should be available tomorrow. Watch the video, buy the book. So night, Brian. Thanks very
Thank
much
you.
For your time.
Thank
Thanks
you so Brian. Much. Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.